All right, thank you. I'm Andy Sherwood. I'm a master's student at the University of Minnesota, and I'll be telling you today about my thesis research with phenotypic diversity in oak leaf hydrangea. So I'll begin by introducing the genus a little bit here. So hydrangea macrophylla is a popular horticultural crop, both as a florist crop, but also as a landscape plant. In 2014, hydrangea macrophylla accounted for $120 million of nursery sales, which makes it one of the biggest nursery crops on the market. There are other species such as hydrangea paniculata and hydrangea arborescens, which are also increasing in popularity throughout the years. The species I've been working with, though, is hydrangea cordifolia, or oak leaf hydrangea, which, much like the other hydrangea species that I just showed you, does have large showy inflorescences, but it also has several unique traits which separate it from the other hydrangeas. One of these is the deeply lobed leaves, which gives the plant a striking texture even when it's not even in flower. And the fall foliage color is far superior to that of any other hydrangea species. And the exfoliating bark gives the plant four seasons of texture, which is important for those of us in northern climates with long winters. So beyond just these unique characteristics, there's an opportunity right now in oak leaf hydrangea. So far, there haven't really been any broad-scale studies in any hydrangea species beyond just looking at cultivars. There haven't been any species-level diversity analyses. Additionally, oak leaf hydrangea, when compared to some of these other hydrangea species, has a relatively young breeding history. So this gives us a good opportunity to begin with a comprehensive evaluation of the species, and that allows us to take a step back and see everything that there is before we really begin. But this is also an opportunity then to incorporate as much wild diversity as possible. And as an analogy, I like to look to hydrangea macrophylla, where there were initially only about 10 or so original progenitors that became the breeding germplasm to now develop almost 1,000 cultivars, which has led to a very limited genetic diversity, which translates to limited phenotypic diversity. So we're in an opportunity to avoid that altogether. So with that, the objectives that I'll be covering today is first of all to identify wild populations of oak leaf hydrangea, as this really wasn't known to begin with beyond just the general area where they occur. And secondly, then I'll be talking about how we're beginning to characterize this wild diversity to understand how much there is for us to utilize. So oak leaf hydrangea is native to the southeastern United States, centered around the states of Alabama and Mississippi, but also grows in a few of the surrounding states. So we can see it's actually a fairly small range of occurrence, which makes it amenable to a comprehensive evaluation of the entire species. So to begin to identify wild populations, I looked at over 400 herbarium specimens by looking at the label of where they had been collected and mapped them out to identify about 90 sites that I believe still would have hydrangeas at them in the wild. So by visiting these sites, I found 74 of them that still had hydrangea. So this map shows the seed collection locations that I was able to find wild hydrangea populations, with the points in red on the map indicating seed that I collected in 2017, and the black points being seed collections from 2018. For the remainder of this talk, I'll be focusing on the 2017 seed collections, just because our seed from 2018, the plants are still too young to have enough data to present. So for my collection strategy, I considered each semi-continuous group of plants to be a population. So typically this was all of the hydrangeas within a given park or natural area. But in some of the larger national forests, there were actually multiple populations that were separated by quite a big distance. Each of my samples consisted of one inflorescence from one plant. So therefore, I considered each of these samples to be maternal half-sibling families. And I sampled up to 25 samples per population, although most of our populations, unfortunately, were quite a bit smaller than that, so I wasn't actually able to get full 25 samples for most of my populations. So the first trait that I looked at in these seedlings is seed germination. So although hydrangea cultivars are clonally propagated, there are also wild-type seedlings that are available in the trade. And in some of my discussions with nursery growers in the Southeast, some of them do collect seed from wild material and germinate them with varying rates of success. So that makes it difficult for them to predict how much seed they need to sow in order to get a predicted or desired crop size. But additionally, this is a practical trait for breeders. So not necessarily that it's a trait that we'd be selecting for, but rather, much like the growers, it's something that's useful to know when we're trying to end up with the target number of seedlings. So in order to evaluate this, I sowed many thousands of seeds from those 17 populations in the greenhouse with bottom heat, and then measured or recorded germination daily for 25 days after the first germination. So this box and whisker plot shows us this germination data, where each box represents all the seedlings from one population with percent germination on the y-axis. So the population means had a huge range from 14 to 97%, which tells us that there certainly would be a big difference depending on which population you choose to grow your seedlings from. But there's also considerable variation within the population, so it's also going to be important if you want consistent germination to choose the right population. For instance, these two on the left-hand side, right-hand side of the plot would be great to choose for production, having both high germination but also fairly low variability. Then the next trait that I looked at is variation in compactness. So full-size cultivars grow to be 2 to 3 meters at maturity. However, consumers and growers are looking for compact, well-branched cultivars. But the problem being that there's only a few sources of compactness available. So although there are several cultivars available, they're all derived from only two sources of compactness, Sykes Dwarf and Peewee. So therefore, we do need new sources of compactness in order to broaden this genetic pool so that we can have more variation among these compact cultivars. So this photo on the left shows us how much variation there is among individual seedlings, with some being extremely tall and some actually being quite short. And now this box plot on the right, now with height on the y-axis, shows us the population level variability. So we see that although there is considerable variation within the populations, the variability within them is, or among them, is actually quite significant. So if we look at these populations here, they almost seem to be qualitatively shorter than the others, which would make them great targets for beginning to breed for compactness, yet there's still enough variation within them to make genetic gain over several cycles of selection. So I found an interesting pattern with these seedlings is that height is negatively correlated with latitude, which means that the northern populations tend to have shorter seedlings on average. So I find it interesting to note that I don't find this correlation when I measured the mother plants in the wild. So that tells me that there's a genetic component here, because when not grown in a common environment, they don't show this pattern. When they are grown in a common environment, we do find the pattern. But it also shows us that there must be some sort of environmental effect impacting this. So these three populations here are interesting outliers because they're considerably shorter than we would expect based on the more general pattern. So in addition to those northern populations, these three also would be interesting to target for compactness breeding. In addition to height, I also looked at the number of branches. However, as the photo on the left shows us, most of the seedlings only had one main stem. There wasn't much branching to measure. But we did actually find one family, these eight seedlings here, from a population in central Mississippi, which was extremely highly branched. So this is a population we'll continue to look at over the next few years as the plants continue to grow and develop. So far, they seem pretty promising. So the last trait I'll talk about today that I measured is cold hardiness. So oak leaf hydrangea cultivars are typically rated to be hardy to zone 5. However, in the wild, they only grow as far north as zone 7A. So this tells us that they must be able to tolerate colder temperatures than they ever naturally experience in the wild. However, we are still limited on where we can grow the plants based on cold hardiness. For example, in Minnesota, in zone 4, we cannot really reliably grow them. But we do actually have some anecdotal evidence with some open pollinated seedlings in our field that have survived for several years, albeit with significant winter injury, but they do survive and occasionally flower for us. So this gave me the idea that there must be some sort of potential that we could push the limits on this and maybe find something that's a little bit hardier than average. So with that, I hypothesized that the northern populations should be more cold hardy than the southern populations, which if we look at this collection map on the left, which are the seedlings that I used for this study, it covers the latitudinal range of the species from 36 degrees north all the way down through 30 degrees north from Tennessee through the panhandle of Florida. So in order to test this, I used a controlled freezing test where I put the seedlings in a minimally heated overwintering structure to keep them cold enough to stay dormant and acclimated going into winter, but to keep them warm enough that they wouldn't experience any lethal injury prior to the beginning of the experiment. So I then sampled stems from each of these plants and color-coded them by population, then combined these stems together into bags to represent the temperature treatments. These bags were then placed into our programmable freezer, where as the temperature in the freezer dropped, I removed the bags for each temperature treatment from minus 10 through minus 35 degrees Celsius. The entire experiment was then replicated 4 times. So then, after allowing the damaged symptoms to appear, I scored them on a scale from 1 through 4 from no damage through completely dead tissue, where in practicality these could really be dichotomized into live stems and dead stems, which is essentially how I ended up analyzing the data anyways. So if we look at the percent survival at minus 35 degrees Celsius, which is that coldest temperature that we tested, we see a huge amount of variation, so ranging from only 4% survival all the way up through 36% survival. So still not great survivability, but enough variability that we have a chance at finding some hardy outliers. So when we look at the LT50, which is the lowest temperature where we expect 50% of the seedlings to die, we find that it is indeed correlated with latitude, consistent with my hypothesis. So this tells us that the northern populations are on average more cold hardy. But again, we find some outliers. So actually, our hardiest population is from the center of the latitudinal range, which really isn't what we expect, but is quite significant in that it's an additional source of cold hardiness beyond just those northern populations. But it also highlights the importance of looking at a broad range of diversity, because you never really know where we're really going to find it. So in all, these plants were much hardier than we really expected. I didn't expect most of them to survive these sort of temperatures. But it does make me hypothesize that midwinter hardiness may not be the limiting factor. Instead, I'm now thinking that fall acclimation or spring deacclimation might be that period where we're experiencing damage in our seedlings. So this is really just scratching the surface. We now have these seedlings planted in the field in 2 locations, both in Minnesota and in Tennessee, where we'll be evaluating them over the next few years. So those seed collections that I mentioned in 2017, we're now growing out those seedlings to look at an even broader range of this diversity to see what other types of interesting traits we can find. Some of the additional traits that we'll be screening, we'll be looking at flowering and disease resistance, but also cold hardiness in the fall and spring, like I just mentioned, and also fall foliage color. So before I'm done here, I'd like to point out that the seed that I collected during this study will be made available through the National Plant Germplasm System, so that any interested researchers and breeders will have access to this germplasm, but also the data that goes along with it. And with that, I'd like to acknowledge our funding sources, the UMN Arboretum Endowed Chair Fund, 2 USDA grants, one for germplasm collection and another for germplasm characterization. Also, I'd like to thank the Horticulture Research Center staff, which helped me grow these plants, and also Dr. Tim Reinhart, who was a part of this project at the beginning before I even joined the project, and he helped identify some of the Mississippi populations. So thank you.
Questions? Any questions?
They were grown in fairly small pots, but they were fairly close together. So there's a chance that that had some impact on branching. But I think the fact that we did find those highly branched seedlings within that same environment tells me that there's at least an ability for them to branch out under those conditions. Yep.
You are evaluating the plants from the seedling.
That's right.
So individual plant is individual genotype?
All of this data is at the population level, so almost everything here is an average from 100 seedlings within each of those populations. So none of this is... Yes, absolutely. Yeah, all of the populations had a huge amount of variation among the seedlings and families within them. So moving forward, looking at the individuals within them.
Okay, so real quick, we got time for one more.
Yeah, this seed is, other than some of the low germination rates, it can be sown immediately after collection. So it's a dry capsule, so the seed just falls right out of the flower and then is ready to sow.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. All right.